The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon. Great to see you here. I wonder what sort of a day you've had, whether you've felt busy. As I talk to people, lots of us just feel busy. There's kind of too many things in our face all the time. I sat down yesterday and worked out there's 9 different ways for people to get in touch with me and so on. Landline, mobile phone, SMS, email, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, snail mail, and occasionally people come to the front door. I don't know about you, but I felt like I rushed from one thing to the next. You feel tired, and often I feel like I've just got to get control of my life. And of course, there's lots of books around that will tell us how to get control of our life. Now, here's one of the better ones that I've read, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. There's Stephen Covey. Not only is he smart, but he's good looking as well. And the reason this book works, it's very useful. He helps us to divide life into different categories, the urgent and the non-urgent, the important and the unimportant, and you work out what fits in different quadrants, and then put it onto a sheet like this, a weekly planner, where you work out your you work out the roles in your life. You know, I'm an employee, I'm a dad, or I'm a mum, or and so on, and then plug those things into your week. And it means you get control of your life. Now, there's lots of ways that we try to get control of our lives, you know, with a diary and time management. Money is actually a kind of a way of having control or power. The more money you have, the more it seems like you're in control. I wonder, too, if information, kind of being on top of what's happening, is a way we try to get control. I think that's part of the attraction or the, could I say, almost addiction of social media, that if I'm on top of Facebook and know exactly what's happening and on Twitter and so on, it's that I'm in control because I'm right up to date. It might be part of the reason why some of us end up news junkies as well. We work hard at getting the people around us to do what we want, to kind of control things that way. But I put it to you that so much of our lives is actually outside our control, that there's so much that we just cannot get the world to do what we want, and we're aware of that. And I think it shows itself in many ways. It shows itself in anxiety. Beyond Blue, the organisation that fights depression, Beyond Blue says that 14% of Australians, that's 1 in 7 Australians, suffer from an anxiety disorder. It shows itself in anxiety. It shows itself in frustration, and frustration shows itself and boils over into anger that we just cannot get what we think we should. You know, the Bible reminds us again and again that we're not in control of our lives. And that's the third of the hard truths that I want to look at today. I know this series is called 5 Truths That Will Transform Your Life. I wanted to call it 5 Hard Truths, but the marketing guys said, no, that won't sell. But here they are on the slide. They're 5 hard truths. Life is hard. Second, your life is not about you. Third, today, you are not in control. And you might like to look forward to coming back next week for you are not that important. And in 2 weeks' time, you're going to die. Now, they're great selling points, aren't they? They're 5 hard truths that the Bible teaches. And yet, when you embrace them, there's a huge upside as well, which we're doing week by week. These headings come from a blog by a man called Charles Pope. If you want to find the blog, 5 Hard Truths That Will Set Us Free. Easy to find using Google. So, you're not in control. Now, you might think, well, no, wait a minute. In terms of achievement and climbing the ladder and so on, as many of us are here in the city, if you're self-disciplined, if you work hard, success is really about just hard work and climbing the ladder. Well, I'll put it to you that there's a whole lot of things that we don't control, and maybe there's more of life out of control than we think. Now, that's the message of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is a book of the Old Testament written about 1000 BC, written by King Solomon or through the eyes of King Solomon. And what he's on about is finding what gives life permanence, what gives life meaning, what has substance, what lasts. And in chapter 9, verse 11, here on the screen or in your program, listen to what he says about what he's seen in life. 9, verse 11, I've seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant or favour to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. You see that last line? Time and chance happen to them all. And it's true, isn't it? Sometimes luck is just what it's all about. Now, how many of you recognise this man? The skater? Yes, Stephen Bradbury. Now, the reason you've heard of Stephen Bradbury is because he had a remarkable thing happen in the 1,000 metre speed skating in 2002 in Salt Lake City. Now, I knew what happened in the final. What I didn't realise is, I went and checked on the Wikipedia page about him, there was a string of just amazing luck beforehand as well. So he just made the quarterfinal, and then to get through the quarterfinal, the only reason he did is because the guy who finished in front of him was disqualified for some reason. Then he got to the semi-final and shouldn't have got through that, except three of the faster skaters fell during the semi-final, and then he made the final when, my memory is, everybody in front of him fell over. And here he is skating around with both arms up and the V for victory sign and a smirk on his face, which is good luck to him. He didn't take himself too seriously. You think, well, yeah, that's kind of an unusual example of just luck. But, of course, really, to get to the very top, it's all about hard work, isn't it, and talent. Well, maybe not. Now, here's a brilliant book by Malcolm Gladwell. He's the author of The Tipping Point, which is great. But this one's called Outliers. Best book I've read for some time. What's he mean? Well, he defines an outlier as someone who is way off the curve statistically. And that is really, he's talking about the very high achievers, exceptional performers in sport, in business, computing, and the IQ stakes and so on. And what he goes through is to analyse all these people who are outliers or super high achievers. And what he will say is that each of them has innate talent, but he's looking at the question, why is it that these particular people got to the top rather than 100 or 1,000 others who have the same level of talent? Now, interestingly, he says to become competitive on the world stage in computer coding or playing an instrument or whatever particular area you've mastered takes around 10,000 hours of practice. Interesting how that number 10,000 comes up again and again. But what he shows, it's not just hard work, it's about a series. In each of these fields, there was a series of lucky breaks, of unplanned things that line up to allow someone to get to the top. So he gives the example of Bill Gates. Now, he's not having a go at Bill Gates in the sense that, you know, Bill Gates is very clever and worked hard. But in the few pages he gives about Bill Gates' life, there's 9 different factors that line up, 9 different lucky breaks that Bill Gates got to make it possible for him to get where he did. He had rich and supportive parents. He went to the right school. The school just happened to have a computer, one of the few schools that did. He had unlimited access to that computer. He just happened to get the right holiday job. He was able to do his 10,000 hours of computer coding when other people didn't have access to it, and so on. Even to the point where Gladwell shows, as personal computing took off in the mid-70s, there was a tiny window for when you needed to be born to really catch the wave. If you were born too early, you missed out. If you were born too late, you would miss out. And Bill Gates is born to within the year or two necessary. Even Gates himself even admits there's a whole series of lucky breaks and he caught the wave. There's another interesting chapter where Gladwell analyses the 75 richest people in history. And this is reaching back, you know, millennia. Cleopatra makes the list. How they worked it all out exactly, I don't know, but there's someone with a propeller hat somewhere has worked this out. Now, here's the interesting thing. Across thousands of years, the 75 richest people in history, and 20% of them 14 out of the 75 were born in a single decade in a single country, right? In a single decade in the same country. And that decade would be born in the 1830s in the United States. Why? Because being born exactly then meant that you were in the position to ride the wave of the economic miracle that happened in the USA. And those men, and he lists the 14 of them, became multi-billionaires. And yet the great irony was, if you were born in the 1920s, you were probably too old to jump on the wave. And if you were born in the 1940s, you missed it. And so, again and again, what comes up is, if you want to get to the very top, you need to choose your year of birth and your parents and your home background very carefully. Now, of course, that's for the super high achievers. For us kind of modest mortals, we control our life in our own little way, and we work to our plans and so on, and life works out as we planned it. And that's not true, is it? In fact, there's a whole series of minor events. Sometimes we don't even realise that they're happening, that are turning points in our whole life. So 1976, I'm a wide-eyed country boy in a country town in New South Wales. I'm planning to go to Macquarie University to study. As one of my mates who's a bit older says, the University of New South Wales, that course is very good, etc., etc. And on the basis of a two-minute conversation, I change my preference to University of New South Wales. I go to New College, and there's 200 rooms at New College, and a 1 in 200 chance that I ended up beside another young guy who was a keen, switched-on Christian, and over 2 years I hear the Christian message, believe in Jesus, and my whole life is changed. In third year of the degree, I make it to the State Library to research an essay. I walk in, and there is the cutest little Chinese girl I've ever seen behind a mountain of books, and I get talking to her, and we're still together 33 years later. And yet, what if I hadn't gone to the library? What if I'd gone an hour later? What if I'd never met her? And here's a picture of us both. And if you know us both, you can see in the picture she's aged a lot better than I have. But isn't that right, as you look back on your own life? The key events, things that have happened that you didn't realise the significance of, you didn't plan it, and yet your whole life is different because you made that little choice or met that particular person and so on. Now, that's looking back. At the moment, now, my guess is that there are people you know that you're worried about, people you wish you could control, people you love who are doing dumb things or whatever, whether that's your kids or your parents or your siblings or your friends. And we tie ourselves in knots with frustration, worrying about people and trying to control them and change them. And guess what? You cannot control other people. We can't. We mustn't make ourselves responsible for the actions of other people. Whether that's your kids, your parents, your siblings, your friends. And wait a minute. If you're a parent, aren't I responsible for the actions of my kids? No, you're never responsible for the actions of another person. Now, when they're little, you can pick them up and move them and so on. But your job, even as they grow, is to be a good parent. After a certain size, you can't physically control them anyway. So it's your job to be a good parent, best father or mother you can be. And the same with your parents. Your job is to be the best son or daughter that you can be. You can't control what your parents do. Your job is to be the best brother or sister you can be to your siblings or the best friend. But you can't make yourself responsible for the actions of other people because, guess what, you cannot control them. And if you try to, well, it'll fail and you'll just drive everybody mad. And looking to the future, well, don't we live with the possibility of tragedy all the time? And I know this, I hear more news of this as I get older, and that is someone, maybe us soon, goes to the doctor and gets the bad news about the particular diagnosis, and over the coming months, life will never be the same again. And sometimes that tragedy is immediate. And if you notice in the Sydney Morning Herald yesterday, a big story about driver fatigue. The story said last year the Roads and Maritime Services recorded 3,329 crashes as being fatigue-related. almost double the number of crashes involving alcohol. And so even if you're not fatigued, you're driving along the road, minding your own business, wide awake, you just need the driver in the other direction to be fatigued, to wander across the median strip, to make a mistake, and bang, life is changed forever. You know, I had a chance to think about that recently. Some of you might know I've become a mammal. There's many mammals where I live over in the eastern suburbs. Mammal is a middle-aged man in Lycra. And I was out on a weekend morning riding. So I'm riding along over near Bondi Junction. I've come into a roundabout. I know I've got to turn right. There's a car right behind me. I can't stop. Got the right hand out, about to turn right. And then towards me is a big white Land Cruiser coming along fairly quickly. And there's a woman driving it. And as I'm about to turn in front of her and she hadn't touched the brakes, I'm thinking, well, if she's not watching or if she's texting or if her kids are screaming and distracted her, I'm dead. And I turn right and she, well, you know the end of the story, I'm still here. But you know, interesting, isn't it? Killed on a bike. It happens. Now, we like to live with the illusion that we control life, but the New Testament says it is an illusion. So towards the end of the New Testament, the letter of James, written by Jesus' half-brother. Have a look on your program or on the screen. Listen to what James says, chapter 4, verse 13. Now listen, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to this or that, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. See what he's saying? They're making plans, got the strategic plan all worked out, and you know, the seven habits of highly effective people sheet filled in and so on. Apparently in the first century, the whole merchant business was booming because the Roman Empire had bought stability and peace and ease of transport across the known world. And so there was a dollar or a drachma or a denarius to be made, and they're planning this. You see what James says, very next verse? Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast and brag. All such boasting is evil. See what he's saying? You don't even know what will happen tomorrow. And yet we're making all these big plans. Notice what he says about our lives. We are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Our lives are fragile and ephemeral. We don't know about tomorrow. And life has gone very quickly. And what are these people doing? Boasting and bragging about all the things that they'll do. You see what James says the wise alternative is? See verse 15. Instead you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. What's he saying? Acknowledge God's will, acknowledge that He controls our lives and what will happen. You see, it's not wrong to plan and it's not wrong to be organized at all. But remember that we are dependent beings and we depend on God's will, on Jesus' will, to see what will happen. I'm now proud owner of an iCal program, so the Apple calendar on my little laptop computer. And I had some spare time on Tuesday. I wanted to know just how far in advance can I plan with my iCal. So I put it on a yearly planner and away we went. Well, the screenshot on the screen is a weekly calendar from the year 2159. I got sick of going further than that. That's the year I turned 200. I figure that's probably far enough for me to need to plan. But you notice that even in 2159, I still have to go to City Bible Forum staff meetings on Monday. There is no escaping those meetings. It's okay to plan. You know, when it comes to year planners, though, I was thinking, do you know the one appointment that you will never see written on a yearly planner? It's never there. And that is funerals. No one ever writes a funeral into a year planner because we're not in control of that. There was a very sad sad funeral this year, in the middle of the year. Stephen R. Covey, July 16, 2012. The news report, quite simple, Salt Lake City. Stephen R. Covey, the author of Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, as well as three other books that have all sold more than a million copies, has died. He was 79. Covey was hospitalised after being knocked unconscious in a bicycle accident on a steep road in the foothills in Utah. Killed on a bicycle. He's a great author about getting life under control. A sad irony, really, to die in a bicycle accident. Listen to what that man, Charles Pope, the man who wrote the blog that gave me these five headings, listen to what he says about control. So the third of his points, you are not in control. Control is something of an illusion. You and I may have plans for tomorrow, but there are many things between now and tomorrow over which I have no control. For example, I cannot even control and guarantee the next beat of my heart. Hence, I may think I have tomorrow under control, but tomorrow is not promised and may never come. Because we think we control a few things, we think we can control many things. Not really. Our attempts to control and manipulate outcomes are comical, if not hurtful. Thinking that we can control many things leads us to think that we must control them. This, in turn, leads to great anxiety and often anger. We usually think that if we're in control, we'll be less anxious. This is not true. We're more anxious. The more we think we can control, the more we try to control, and thus the greater our burdens and anxiety. In the end, we get angry because we discover that there are many things and people we cannot control after all. This causes frustration and fear. We would be freer and less anxious if we would simply accept the fact that there are many things, most things, over which I have no control. Our expectation of everything being under control is unrealistic. Life comes at you fast, and brooding over unpredictable things and uncontrollable matters is bondage. Simply accepting that I'm often not in control is freeing. It's interesting that Jesus teaches we don't control our world and our lives, but we need not be afraid or anxious if we belong to God, if we follow him and can call God our Father. Have a look what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 10, on the screen or in the program. Matthew chapter 10, verse 29, Jesus says, "Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You're worth more than many sparrows." You see, it's not chance or luck that runs our world. It's God. God who's in charge of the fall of the sparrow or the hairs on our head. God controls the details of life. Now, at the risk of kind of mouthing a cliche, I guess it's a cliche, but it's a great summary. That's this. We do not know what the future holds, but we can know the one who holds the future. We don't know what the future holds, but we can know the one who holds the future. So we saw 2 weeks ago in the first truth about life is hard, that God promises if you belong to Jesus, if you will trust him, that he will use everything that happens in life for our good. It doesn't mean that life will be easy. It doesn't mean there won't be hard things in life. But God promises that he'll use everything for our good to mold us and shape us and make us like Jesus. To change our character, to change who we are. And so we need not fear the present or the future. So what is it that the Bible writers, James and Jesus himself, what is it they want us to do? To acknowledge that God is God and we are not. I guess in the Bible's terms it's saying they call us to humble ourselves. That's what Peter, one of Jesus' followers, writes too in Peter's first letter to the Christian people. 1 Peter 5 verse 6, he says, "Humble yourselves therefore under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you." Humble yourselves. What's it really mean? God, what does God want from us? To acknowledge reality, really, that he is God and we are not. In fact, all five of these truths are about coming to terms with reality, our place in the world, and God's place in charge. To acknowledge that He is God and we are not. And what will the effect of that be? See verse 7, it deals with anxiety. Cast all your anxiety on Him because He's in charge and He controls the world. And notice, because He cares for you. For the follower of Jesus, it's learning to pray, and that's what he means, cast your anxiety on Him, learning to pray rather than be anxious. Now, it's a hard thing to do, isn't it, to learn to pray rather than worry. Prayer is a great act of not just trust in God, but of humility. Prayer is actually acknowledging that God is in control and we are not. Let me conclude with one more point. 350 years ago, in 1662, there's a very famous edition of the Anglican Prayer Book was published. In fact, the 1662 Prayer Book is still used in some Anglican churches in Sydney and around the country. And I suppose 350 years ago, there was even more of the world and of life that was not under control. And the prayer book, as it was prayed day by day, aimed to teach people how to relate to God in the right way and to give comfort. And listen to this prayer that was to be prayed at the end of the day. So this is a prayer, 1662, a prayer at the end of the day. It's on your screen. Let me read it for you. Be present, O merciful God, and protect us through the silent hours of this night, so that we who are wearied by the changes and chances of this fleeting world may rest upon your eternal changelessness through Jesus Christ our Lord. We who are wearied, I feel tired, I bet you do too at different times. Wearied by what? By the changes and chances of this fleeting world, a world beyond our control. And we may rest how? In your eternal changelessness through Jesus Christ. And what's the bottom line? We're not in control of our world or our lives, but we can find rest and confidence in the one who is in control.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.